On February 10, 2005, New York civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart was convicted of conspiracy, providing material support to terrorists, and defrauding the U.S. government. Yet Stewart never provided any financial support, weaponry, or any other concrete aid for any act of terrorism. No act of terrorism is alleged to have resulted from her actions. Her trial was held in the same courtroom where Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were tried for conspiracy to commit espionage more than 50 years ago. Lynn Stewart will be sentenced in September, and she faces up to 30 years in prison. Her supporters argue that all she did was to represent her client effectively and zealously, as a good attorney should. I'm very pleased to be joined by Lynn this afternoon. Hello, Lynn. Can you hear me, Lynn?
What?
Can you hear me?
No.
No? Uh-oh.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great, great.
I hope that I'll speak up and hope you can hear me better. So your sentencing is in September. I'm wondering what's happening between now and then. What are you doing, and what are you asking others to do? My understanding is that you currently cannot practice law. Is that right?
Well, I can't practice law, but of course that's freed me up to going out and speaking out all over as many places as I can get permission to go to speak out about the case. And I've been doing that pretty regularly. We've been to Hartford, Philadelphia, Boston, you name it. So that's very important. And part of this is part of a massive letter-writing campaign to the judge, who I'm assured will read every letter. He's not exactly the milk of human kindness, but he is a compulsive person who will read all the letters. So we're urging people to write a letter to the judge. You can go to my website and get all the particulars. But we think it's that kind of an issue, that if we write to the judge and we get him to understand how many people are concerned on many, many levels, lawyers, regular people, political activists, that we maybe can turn this around. He has the power to give me probation.
He could give you no time at all in prison.
Exactly.
That's one of his options. He could give you between 0 and 30 years, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so it might be helpful to explain to people what some of the problems are in this case, so when they do write a letter, they'll know what to say. Your website is lynnstewart.org, right?
For exactly.
Okay, who want more information?
And what we're hoping people will do is we want people to write conscientiously and from the heart and to talk about what this case, what it portends for the movement, because I think it has serious implications for the movement. That is, that movement lawyers will no longer be available, and that also lawyers who might have a tendency to get involved will no longer be so willing to do it. This is definitely meant as a warning shot to lawyers.
If we could talk just a little bit about some of the facts in the case, so people who may not have heard of you, which it's hard to believe that there are people who listen to this station who haven't, because Democracy Now! Has covered the issue pretty well, but and we play that regularly on this station, but there is quite a few people who I've talked to who don't know who you are. So maybe we could talk about how you were convicted in the first place. What was the substance of this case? Maybe you could begin with how you were appointed to represent Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman in the first place, and then go from
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Well, I was actually approached by Ramsey Clark, whose name surfaces over and over again in this prosecution, and asked if I would be available to do that. I went and interviewed with the Sheikh and actually was the attorney of choice, but I felt that in my compulsive state that I wouldn't be able to adequately prepare for the case. But Ramsey assured me that I was the last best hope and that whatever else went on, you know, if a fireman is passing a burning building with a child inside, you must put on your fireman's boots. You can't say, I don't have my hat, I don't have my pick. You have to rescue that child. So I was convinced that I had to do this, and we went ahead with a 10-month trial. Near the end of the trial, the judge in federal court did appoint me to be his counsel. And actually, I represented him through appeal and through an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States.
What was he convicted of to begin with? What was he convicted of?
In 1995, and this was a 10-month trial, he was convicted of being part of a conspiracy to attack New York landmarks. I personally, I think everybody recognizes this, I wept at the point of conviction because I felt it was such a miscarriage of justice that he had been convicted because of the prejudice of the jury. And I hope we don't have to wait 40 years like we have had to wait in Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner to get some vindication on this, but I felt that there was a terrible prejudice abroad in the land, and that is in part what convicted him.
So you continued to represent him after he was convicted. At what point were you then indicted? It was in March of 2002, isn't that right?
Yes.
What was the claim?
Myself and Ramsey Clark and Abdeen Jabara, we were a team. We were all committed to the Sheikh. We were all representing him. I visited him in May of 2000, and at that point I issued a press release on his behalf. This is the sole act that I committed that the government has focused on and used as a gravamen of this offense. I issued a press release to Reuters, done completely openly, no Abdul the Parrot sings at midnight stuff. It was basically a phone call to the Reuters reporter in Cairo. I gave him the press release from the Sheikh, whom I had recently visited, and he printed it the next day.
What was the content of the press release? What was in there?
Well, the government has always seen fit to characterize it as the Sheikh calls off the ceasefire. Actually, a better reading of the entire thing and a clarification which was issued the following week indicates that the Sheikh wanted to have a discussion ensue among the people in his group, the Islamic congregation, Jamaat Islamiyah, about whether this ceasefire that they had engaged in with the Egyptian government was in fact carrying out the wishes. As I'm sure your listening audience knows, the Egyptian government is one of the most repressive on the face of the earth, arresting any political dissidents, subjecting them to torture. Indeed, it's one of the countries to whom this country renders, and I use that word, persons to be tortured on behalf of the U.S. government. So when he questioned the efficacy of a ceasefire with this government, which was executing teenagers, which was arresting people who had nothing to do with anything, but they were the relatives of people the government had targeted, he questioned the efficacy of a ceasefire. Of course, this was reported in the press as the Sheikh calling for an end to the ceasefire. It was never that. There was never an end to the ceasefire called. Indeed, Attorney General Ashcroft, when asked, well, what happened after she issued the press release, said to the throngs of press who had gathered, well, I'm sorry to say, well, he was sorry to say, nothing ever happened.
The government also claimed that your continued representation was just a ruse so that you could aid the Sheikh in getting messages out to his followers. There was another element to what you were accused of, something to the effect of being present during some letters that were passed. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm smiling here at my end of the phone because actually, you know, lawyers routinely, when they go in to visit a client who has been imprisoned, especially under the onerous conditions, I could say the torturous conditions that the Sheikh was imprisoned over, we routinely bring in letters from the family, letters from followers, letters from supporters, because we think, and we are rightly so in thinking, given the ethics rules, that this is part of our work. So, yes, we did bring in messages. There was no message that said, when shall we attack the barracks? Where is the gold buried? There was no such message. The only messages had to do with his family. They had to do with the conduct of the organization of which he had been a part for many years, but which was completely peaceful and remained completely peaceful from 1997 right up till the present.
If what you're saying is true, how did they convict you? I mean, what evidence did they use? What did they present in court to argue their side?
Well, we all know that there is a terrible fear abroad in the land, and that this fear is exploited by this particular administration. In other words, the populace, and indeed this particular jury, was convinced that they were part of the government war on terror. I don't believe that if they were polled individually today, they would come with the same result. But at the time, after the summations and after which the image of bin Laden was portrayed in, I can only say, 8-foot by 20-foot screen version, that they were convinced that there was something to be afraid of and that this government was necessary to protect them. And so, just like we understand the nature of fascism to be, they capitulated. They allowed the government to say, she is guilty and we will go along with it.
So the evidence that they presented in court consisted of news clippings that the Justice Department had sent you, as well as they had eavesdropped on some of your conversations with your client. Can you talk about what the specific things were that they presented in court that supposedly built their case against you?
Definitely, because I think this is very important for people to understand. The evidence in the case was basically wiretaps against my co-defendant. He testified that I knew nothing about the people he was talking about, and indeed, I did know nothing about them. It also consisted of listening in on attorney-client conversations, not just for an hour or so, but for 2 days solid. You know, we have always felt that when an attorney talks to a client, this is a sacred ground. We don't intrude upon that because it's so important to the relationship between an attorney and its client, or her client in this case. So that this was an absolutely outrageous thing for the government to do. These wiretaps, this listening in, were not directed at me. They were directed at foreign intelligence, national security. These are the buzzwords that this administration uses to excuse the most egregious conduct in the world. Whether it's torture at Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo or listening in an American prison in the middle of Minnesota, this is how they get around this. The government also summed up in such a way as to make this jury feel that if they didn't go along with the government, they were somehow disloyal as Americans. That's a very powerful message to most people, and a completely unfair one, I might add.
So they eavesdropped, and I'm assuming they recorded what went on. Did they present this in court as evidence of your supposed conspiracy, your involvement in a conspiracy?
They did present it in court. Some people have said this has been the most, publicized trial and the most boring trial, because basically they presented it in court as transcripts of conversations. But the fact of the matter is that they were unable to prove that these conversations ever led to anything of violence. This, of course, is what the American public is looking for, violence. And I have to say that the fact of the matter is that nothing ever occurred as a result of either the press release, of listening into the conversations, of anything the Sheikh ever said. So that, in a sense, this is really a shell of a prosecution.
What about the...
That is, it lays out a parameter, but that parameter was really never fulfilled.
They also presented in court news clippings about terrorist acts that took place internationally, but these were news clippings that the Justice Department had sent you to assist in your case. Isn't that right? And those were used in court to argue that you had a certain state of mind, quote-unquote, to prove
right.
your state
in
of mind.
In other words, they had to prove that I mentally was aware of and also that I intended for terrorism to take place. So they had seized these newspaper articles, mostly from the New York Times, and I guess that should be a warning to any of your listeners who, like me, are born in the wool clippers. That is, when we go read a newspaper, we're always taking out articles because these clippings were found in my office. However, these clippings were supplied to me in connection with another case and just happened to be in the same box along with the Sheikh's material and other material collected on behalf of Islamic clients.
Also, Osama bin Laden's name was brought up during the trial. How did that get brought in? How was that introduced?
As you know, and as I spoke out against at the point of my conviction in February, bin Laden was brought into the trial, and the judge must have said 100 times, this has nothing to do with the defendant Stewart. This is only introduced not as proof, but just as showing a connection to the defendant Sattar. He was our activist. He was the person who worked as a paralegal. But the judge must have said 100 times, this has nothing to do with Ms. Stewart. This has nothing to do with the case. Bin Laden has not been named as a co-conspirator. So here we were. But with that huge image on the screen, I think it was impossible for a jury to actually step aside and disregard that, even though the judge instructed them to do so. As I said, you can't drop a skunk in the jury box and then tell the jury, don't smell it.
Now, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark was another one of Rahman's attorneys, and he did the exact same things that you did. Why is he not being prosecuted?
Well, as you know, I'm not a prosecutor, nor have I ever been one. But I have to assume, and of course Ramsey has been absolutely supportive and marvelous. He testified at the trial. But the fact of the matter is his father was a United States Supreme Court justice. My father was a school teacher in Queens, New York. I have to think that something about the class differences, the fact that I have been a defense attorney for my entire career, something about the fact that he was a United States attorney, made Ashcroft believe that even he could not carry this off, and that he had to basically bring it against me, the woman, or as my supporters say, the girl, and also against the person who was an espoused leftist. I can only say that Ramsey Clark testified. He was also named as a unindicted co-conspirator, which is a shame to the entire United States government. And he testified that we did what we did, including the press release, because we thought it was the right thing to do for the client. And actually, that is the motivation. We were all lawyers acting like lawyers in the face of tremendous government repression.
Speaking with Lynn Stewart, she's a New York civil rights attorney who was recently convicted and is facing up to 30 years in prison. And the indictment was based on governmental monitoring of conversations that took place between you and your client as well as your co-defendant and your client. These things happened 2.5 years before September 11, 2001, and a few years before your indictment. Why did they wait so long to indict you? You've also talked about how they changed the rules and they moved the goalposts. Can you talk about why they waited so long, as well as what you mean by changing the rules?
Right. Well, may you ask, I have very little doubt that because it served their political agenda, they waited all that time. It's not only waited, I don't think. I think they had basically dismissed the matter completely. We had talked about it. We had signed on again. We had gone in. I had gone in to see the sheikh again in July 2001. But, you know, when September 2001 erupted before their eyes, they really had no cases. They had all this power, all this money, Homeland Security, Patriot Act, and yet all they had was, you're going to hear the New York Fire Department coming by here, but they had very little to substantiate any of these contentions. So the bottom line was that they brought this case because at that point, April 2002, 6 months after 9/11, they basically needed a case to substantiate what they were saying. This case wasn't the case. I was 6 months earlier. It was a different world. But also, the facts of the case did not substantiate any terrorist activity. The only thing that worked for them was that Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman had been convicted, and this made it easy to parlay this into a situation such as they did.
So what of your co-defendants? What kind of time are they facing? Have they both been convicted? And is there any effort to for people to work on their behalf?
Oh, certainly. They're all well represented. Mr. Yusri, who is the interpreter who was convicted, is basically, he's still free on bail, as I am. And he is working daily with his lawyers to put together an appeal, but also to work toward the sentencing. Mr. Sattar is confined in jail, but I note that his lawyers have put out an appeal to the Islamic community, asking them to support him. And I do believe that all of us need the support of the communities, because we basically are people who serve the communities in which we lived. I know I, for 30 years, have been a lawyer for those disenfranchised and those persons who are least likely to get a vigorous defense. Mohammed Yusri was an interpreter working on his PhD. He has suffered because he was cut off from that PhD and from his teaching, which provided him with an income. Last week, the ACLU has actually chastised the CUNY, City University of New York, for the way in which they dealt with Mohammed Yusri and his offense, that they summarily dismissed him. Ahmed Sattar was an activist, but we all know that there is supposedly no law against being an activist, and yet actually this man, who did nothing but talk on his telephone from Staten Island, New York, is basically looking at a life sentence based on those conversations alone.
Is there information on your website at lynnstewart.org about your co-defendant?
There definitely is, and we are inviting everybody to please look at that, to write a letter if this case makes you makes the hair on the back of your neck rise, or makes you feel like you're incensed, or makes you feel threatened, or makes you feel like you as an activist is never going to get a lawyer that can really fight your case. For all the reasons and 100 others, you should look at the website and write a letter for us. We really, really would appreciate it.
I just have a couple more questions for you, if you don't mind.
No problem.
Do you think that this this attack on you was meant to, and your co-defendants, is meant to intimidate lawyers into not representing clients with unpopular beliefs?
I think that that was their underlying motivation. I think that they have, in many, many ways, sent messages to lawyers, whether they're the asbestos lawyers, whether they're the lawyers at Guantanamo, whether they're the lawyers that do bankruptcy cases. This government has made it very clear that they consider lawyers to be an aggravation, not a help. And I think that in my case, it's even more than that, because the message that is sent is that if you actually vigorously defend an enemy of the state, you too may be declared an enemy of the state.
Why do you believe it's important for people who are, quote, enemies of the state to get this vigorous defense? What if they are a terrorist?
Well, I don't think that that's very difficult to answer. And I think it's because in the long history and in the history that is even more recent, we understand that it is unto the least of us that a vigorous defense, that a true case must be fought in order for any of us to get the defense we expect. And even though it's very easy for people to say, I'm not under indictment, I'm never going to be charged as a criminal, the fact of the matter is this government has shown they are capable of charging people with crimes that never existed before. And I think that we all understand that the great bulwark of a lawyer who will go into court and fight for the defense of their clients, is really the strongest thing that a person can have when the might of the state is brought to bear against an individual.
Do you think that this time we're living in now compares to the, say, the McCarthy period of the 50s, the repression?
You know, it's interesting you should ask that, because it's been in conferences on the West Coast. The people who lived through the 50s and lived through being subpoenaed to the UAC and et cetera, have said to me, you know, this is really worse than that period, because at least in that period they went after the individuals. Now they are going after the lawyers, and that puts a completely different cast on the matter. In other words, it's not the individuals, it's the defenders of the individuals. And we have seen this in case after case, in Chile, in other areas, where the first thing they did was they arrested the lawyers, and then the activists were fair game. They had no one left to defend them.
So I just have one final question for you, Lynn. When people are writing letters to the judge, which you say is very important because the judge actually has the discretion to give you no time in prison between 0 and 30 years and could just give you probation if he so chose, so the letter writing is something you're asking people to do and you believe he will actually read these letters, what do you think, can you go over just finally in conclusion what you think some of the basic arguments are in this case?
Sure. I hope that the letters that come in, and we've received hundreds so far, would be conscientious and honest. I mean, I know people don't know me. They may have heard me on your program. They have may have read an article about me. They may go to the website. But I think that what's really very clear is that, as I said the first day of my conviction, we have to be concerned about when they start up locking up the lawyers for doing what is expected of them. And for that reason, I think people ought to write letters, specifically the people who sense that this is a frontal attack on the movement.
And again, Lynn, if you could just say, when you say attacking attorneys for doing what is expected of them, can you spell out what it is,
sure,
again, that you did that it would be?
I made a press release. I think that given the canons of ethics as we know them now, this is something that lawyers are expected to do. We are expected to counter the massive publicity the government puts out. And even beyond that, I think we are expected to put out that which is true on behalf of the client. So, I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that it is this press release that was the gravamen of my offense, And that is because the government considers that it has the media sewn up. We see this in the last week when they cut off the funding for NPR and PBS. And now they have done a gracious thing. They have restored $100 million of the $200 million they cut. So I'm saying that when I made a press release in the name of a man who was recognized as a scholar, as a truth teller in the Middle East, they naturally become very, very upset. But the fact of the matter is, this is part of the lawyer's job. This is what we are instructed to do by the law of ethics, by the rules of ethics. And actually, in this particular case, it was absolutely the right thing to do. So therefore, I hope that people will talk about press releases. We all know that if they had attempted to gag Mumia Abu-Jamal in his prison cell, there would never have been a movement to set him free or to question the bona fides of his conviction.
They did attempt to silence him many times, but failed.
Exactly.
But you're right, that is necessary for his voice to get out, to build any kind of movement, or for his case to be known. And you're saying that was your motivation in the press release.
Absolutely, my motivation, none other. And and although the government seeks to portray it as carrying in messages, as putting out a press release to foment violence, this is completely untrue.
Mm-hmm. So people can go to your website again at lynnstewart.org to read articles, to see how to write to the judge. Do you have a framework, a form letter, anything like that? Or
yes, it's in there. There's a sort of a floating banner that says this is how you write to the judge, and gives all the instructions and all what is necessary and just who to address it to and send it to, I'm sure.
Can people email?
I think so. I tell you, I'm not 100% sure, but there is an email address, and if people want to email their letters, we'll make sure they get to the right place.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lynn.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
Yes, and hello out there, Santa Cruz, and my friends, Linda Evans, and also who do good work around Santa Cruz.
I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Talk to you soon. Bye. That was civil rights attorney, New York civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. She was convicted on February 10th, 2005 of conspiracy, providing material support to terrorists and defrauding the U.S. government. Yet she never provided any financial support, weaponry, or other concrete aid for any act of terrorism. No act of terrorism is alleged to have resulted from her actions. She will be sentenced in September. She faces up to 30 years in prison. They are asking, Lynn's supporters and Lynn Stewart are asking, that you write letters to the judge explaining why this case disturbs you and that you want Lynn to receive zero prison time. As you heard her arguing just there, she says that all she was doing was representing her client effectively and zealously as a good attorney should, and that this is an attempt to suppress that, to have a chilling effect on attorneys and intimidate them. And if you want to read more about her case, her website is lynnstewart.org. Lynn is spelled L-Y-N-N-E, lynnstewart.org, to learn more, to write a letter to the judge. There's also information on there about her co-defendants. It's a very good website. It has a lot of information, a lot of articles, and I encourage you to check it out, lynnstewart.org.